A couple of hundred years ago, making a cup of coffee was pretty straightforward. You added coffee to hot water, boiled it, and poured it in a cup. And the results were often pretty disgusting. One historian of the subject once told me that the whole history of the beverage is about repeated attempts to find some way of making coffee that tastes as good as it smells. Which is perhaps the reason why over the last century there's been a plethora of devices as designers have tried their hand at making the perfect cup of coffee. For By Design, Colin Bissett has been considering trends in coffee-making apparatus and the fads he has followed himself during years of coffee drinking.
I think we agree that good design improves life. Everything from a simple spoon to a computer program can be redesigned to look better and work better. And naturally we enjoy using them because they do their job well. But however much we might prefer driving a car with controls that are particularly easy to use, ultimately the design of an engine efficiently turning four wheels is the one that really counts. That is what will get us from A to B. And we'll happily use a cheap old biro if something better isn't available. The point is that in most cases we carry out tasks regardless of the design of the product. So can the design of an object actually make us do things we might not have done before? I suppose I vacuum more often than I used to after I bought one of those bagless vacuum cleaners that delivers what it promises, no loss of suction. I'm more inclined to use it because it does its job so well, and this means that I live in a slightly cleaner house than I did before. Everyone, except the dust mite, is happy. But I would still vacuum if I didn't have that particular model. And then it struck me that the fact that I drink coffee is almost wholly based on design. Allow me to explain. It all started when I was 7 and noticed that the shape of our coffee pot at home was different from the teapot. "Why is it taller?" I asked my mother. I imagine her looking at her young son with dismay, wondering why he wasn't like other young boys who asked questions about footballs and cars. "It's traditional," she told me, and I have yet to find a better answer. I became intrigued by coffee. My mother went to coffee mornings, which were special enough to involve perfume and smart clothes. She talked about real coffee, which was made after lunch on Sundays, as opposed to the instant stuff that was drunk all other times. My grandmother had an electric coffee percolator made from shiny chromed steel, which would burp quietly on the kitchen bench as it released a wonderful aroma that filled her house. She would pour this dark brew into special cups. "They're Danish," she told me proudly, because anything Danish at that time was all the rage. I admired their simple shape, which had none of the primness of a teacup. Coffee was simply different. Different shaped pot, different shaped cups, and apparently a world of difference between instant and real. And then we went on holiday to Italy. I think it was then that I really fell for coffee. After a hard morning admiring cheap souvenirs in the markets, we would stop at an outdoor cafe for a cappuccino. The sachets of sugar that were placed alongside the cup were printed with pictures of exotic butterflies. But nothing was more exotic than this coffee, with its frothy top and final dusting of chocolate. Although I never drank coffee in Britain, I drank it here because this froth was not only delicious, it spoke of difference. In this case, the difference of the continent. The two became linked in my juvenile mind. Coffee was for those seeking difference. Except that in the 1970s, coffee was mainstream. Manufacturers of instant coffee promised endless taste variations from richer and fuller to mellower and milder, and even more French. Restaurants served coffee spiked with liqueurs in glasses topped with cream for their more hedonistic clients. And kitchen benchtops were cleared to make way for the latest gadget, a filter coffee maker. It was easy to use, with its filter paper and warming plate to keep the glass jug hot all day. Suddenly, everyone's kitchen resembled a roadside diner on Route 66. It was now possible to refresh your cup. Of course I fell for it. When I first left home, I made sure I had one in my new shared flat. But something wasn't quite right. I only really wanted one cup of coffee, not a whole jug, and it became a hassle to remember to buy filter papers as well as coffee, so I went back to instant. At work, someone bought a French cafetiere. It was so easy. Tip in ground coffee and fill up with hot water, leave it a while, and then plunge the filter down. I liked the elegance of the glass jug sitting within its chrome frame and its ebonized handle. OK, so sometimes someone pressed the filter down too hard and the pressure shattered the glass, sending hot coffee over the desk. But we didn't care. We thought ourselves sophisticated. After all, this was exactly like the coffee you might buy in a left bank bistro, we told ourselves. But something was still wrong. I began to realise that spooning coffee into a plunger pot was no different from spooning tea into a teapot. The sense of difference I craved just wasn't there. The answer for me lay in the Italian stovetop coffee maker I bought simply because its shape intrigued me. Blame it on that holiday in Italy, but something told me that the Italians really knew something about coffee. Invented in 1933, the Mokka coffee maker was simple to use, yet it required a certain amount of fussing, filling the bottom section with water, topping up the middle section with coffee, then screwing the whole thing together. You had to really want a coffee to do that. Something about this procedure clicked in my mind. For a start, you couldn't really do anything wrong. I loved the industrial simplicity of its metal construction and its faceted sides. I loved the black handle and the way the narrow spout directed a precise stream of black coffee into the cup. I loved the way the whole thing steamed violently when the coffee was ready. What's more, it was Italian, so when I prepared my morning fix, I was momentarily transported to a Tuscan farmhouse or a flat in Rome. And incidentally, the coffee tasted good too. I've never been wooed by the expensive electric coffee machines that are popular today. Just you wait until you taste this, say friends who have them, and I stand back and yawn as they fiddle forever to produce a coffee that they proudly proclaim tastes as good as anything served in a cafe, just not a cafe that you'd be in a hurry to visit again, I always want to say. And what's the fun in just pressing buttons? If I want silky milk, then I'll go to a proper cafe, thanks. I really believe that the design of the stovetop coffee maker has meant that I drink coffee every day. Although I enjoy the coffee itself, it's the process that rewards me most, and that is all down to its design. The ritual of screwing it all together and placing it on the stovetop has become, I'm ashamed to say, a minor highlight of my day. A slogan of a cafe I visit proclaims that life is too short for bad coffee. But surely they mean life is too short for badly designed coffee makers.
If I can't take my coffee break, my coffee break, my coffee break. If I can't take my coffee break, something within me dies.
Dies down and something within me dies.
If I can't make 3 daily trips where shining shrine benignly drips and taste cardboard between my lips, something within me dies.
Dies down.
From How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. Well, do you have a favourite coffee making machine or a badly designed one? Go on link and comment on the link to this story at abc.net.au/rn/by design. Coming up soon on By Design, how to future-proof a school.